of State v. McNeil. May we please have appearances of counsel? Welcome, counsel. Ms. Bloom, you can approach from this side today. We noticed the change of scenery for you. Well, the other side of the courtroom.
Your clients who are seeking justice, Your Honor. a defendant who enters a guilty plea... Oh, I'd like to reserve a few minutes for rebuttal, if
that's
I may.
Fine.
A defendant who enters a guilty plea gives up fundamental constitutional rights, the right to remain silent, to have the state prove the charges against him beyond a reasonable doubt. Because so much is at stake, he must understand the rights he's waiving. And in addition, Rule 392 says that a defendant who gives up those rights, the court also has to be sure that he is really guilty of the offense, that he understands what he's pleading to, and what the punishment is. This case is about the defendant's understanding of the punishment, or in the words, the rule, the penal consequences. This court has made it clear that the penal consequences include the credit the defendant will receive against his sentence so that he understands the real time he will have to serve in prison. Mr. McNeil got confusing and misleading advice about the credit and specifically about the jail credit he would receive against the 8.5-year parole term under indictment number 1056, which Mr. McNeil, along with everyone else in the courtroom, including defense counsel, the prosecutor, and the judge, understood was the controlling sentence in this plea agreement. Mr. McNeil was told that he had earned 2,438 days of jail credit. Jail credit is day-for-day credit that's applied to the front end of the sentence, including the parole disqualifier. And while Mr. McNeil was pleading to 5 indictments, the only indictment and the only sentence discussed or even mentioned at the plea hearing was the 8.5-year parole disqualifier on number 1056, because, again, the 8.5-year parole disqualifier was the controlling sentence. Once Mr. McNeil served the 8.5 years, he was eligible for parole. The judge told him that there were different kinds of credit, but she also told him no less than 3 times that the 2,438 days were his jail credit.
So how about page 38 of the transcript? So I cannot represent to you right now whether the jail credit, which is the jail credit, that will that has been provided to me, is that 2,438. I cannot represent to you that will affect you on the sentence and in particular parole ineligibility. Do you understand that? Yeah. And then she goes on.
Yes, Your Honor.
Strikes me as the court saying don't count on those days necessarily applying.
That is obviously an accurate quote, but it is not all that went on. And I would start at page 33 on line 5, which is where they first begin to discuss the credit. And that's where defense counsel begins by saying, that's again page 33, line 5, judge, I just want to add that it's clear it's been represented to counsel and to the court and to the state, and therefore I represented it to Mr. McNeil that a time of sentencing with respect to indictment 1056, which is again the 8.5-year parole disqualifier, he's entitled to 2,438 days. He's entering this plea with that understanding.
So that's on 33, but on 39, she seems to be in corrective mode, the judge. Page 39, I don't want you to accept this plea thinking that anybody is telling you that is going to be applied to your parole ineligibility. Do you understand that? Answer, yes.
That's
goes
right.
On.
That's right. And
that's the way this transcript seems to be concluding.
There are 3 times where the judge expressly refers to this as jail credit. Jail credit is day-for-day credit. Then she tells him that there are other kinds of credit. And that's true, there are. But there's only one meaning for jail credit. So the judge tells him it's jail credit. Jail credit has one meaning. It means you get day-for-day credit. Then the judge tells him, well, maybe you won't get it all as credit against 1056. And then she tells him, well, maybe you will get it. It's not clear.
She seems to say a number of occasions, I don't want you to take this plea with the expectation that it's going to affect your parole ineligibility. What else should the judge have said?
You can't at the same time say, maybe you'll get it, and then tell him, but it's a jail credit. Jail credit isn't maybe, and jail credit isn't a credit against anything except the sentence and the parole disqualifier.
But it can't be
both things.
The number, well, jail credit is what it is. The number can fluctuate depending on how it's calculated, and that's what the judge, I think, was saying. You will get jail credit based on day-to-day credit. However, don't count on it being the 2038 or whatever the number
was. Well, but here's the problem, Your Honor. Nobody mentioned to this defendant at any time, at any place in this plea hearing, that the 2,438 days, which are jail credit, was actually going to be divided up against the other indictments.
But at the time that number is mentioned, he'd only been in jail for 3 years. So how could it possibly have added up to that number for this offense that we're talking about?
And I don't really understand how we can expect Mr. McNeil to understand the minutiae of jail credit when his attorney starts out by saying this is indictment 1056, this is the 8.5-year parole disqualifier.
And then the prosecutor stands up and says, this makes absolutely no sense. Can you tell us under what theory it does make sense that you could get 6.5 years of jail credit after having spent less than 3 years in jail?
The quagmire of jail credit is not really something that I think the defendant understood.
But that's a pretty basic concept, would you agree? You don't get double the time for credit than you actually served.
Your Honor, that's why I'm not asking for him to get 2,438 days of jail credit, because I agree, he is not entitled to it.
But that's a slightly different question. The question is what happened in this proceeding and what was and was not understood and what was reasonable to understand. So under what reasonable theory could someone walk away thinking they were entitled to double the credits here?
Because they got a piece of paper in advance from the three women who calculated it, apparently from the probation department, that defense counsel mentions in his opening, where he says it's been represented that he's getting 2,438 days. The defendant was in, apparently, at that time, an aggregate of 2,438 days. For him to understand how it's distributed, that's why they're discussing it. That's why the first thing trial counsel said is it looks like he's getting it. In fact, as the court knows, as I understand, he was not entitled to it. No one told him, there's no way you're getting 2,438.
Counsel, but at sentencing, he had the pre-sentence report, the correct number is in there, and there is no protest registered at that point in time. So how do we reconcile that with this, what appears to be an unreasonable assertion of understanding back at the time of taking the plea?
Your Honor, you're right, and I would ask you to take a look at the sentencing transcript and see what he was told. It is true that he did not jump up and down when the judge said you're getting 1,012 days on 1056 against the 8.5 years. But that's the first thing we discussed when I came on board, because the defendant at that point didn't understand it, and I think it becomes clear why that happened if you look at the sentencing transcript. If you look at page 4, I think it starts on page 4 of the sentencing transcript, on line 18, they talk about, that's what defense counsel points out, that now his credit's up to 4,000 days, specifically 4,727.
Right.
And he argues...
He makes an argument for that amount of time.
Maybe he should get all of that.
And it's rejected.
That's right. And then
he actually gets all the time.
Yeah, but nobody again explained to him.
He winds up getting jail credits on the 13 years to which he's not entitled.
Yeah.
He winds up getting 3,715 days.
Your Honor,
okay. I know that's not before us.
No, I will address that.
Okay.
I will address that.
Go ahead.
But if I may, I wanted to just finish what we were talking about with what was told to him at the sentencing.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at, so I started on page 4 where counsel makes the argument about 4,000, then it goes on to page 5 where the prosecutor says, and understandingly, I would hope the defendant does not get 4,000 days credit. And then if you look at the next page, would be 13, where this comes up. No, I'm sorry, page 10, where he says, this is the judge. What the parole board does...
What page are we on now?
10.
This is page 10, line 16. The judge says what the parole board does, what the Department of Correction does with respect to these credits, and then she trails off. And then if you go back, go to the next page, page 12, the judge says at the top, and how the parole board of the Department of Corrections looks at that, it may be another issue.
Can we go to the last part where the judge says, okay, so again, Mr. McNeil, you're entering into this guilty plea and you stand that there's no representation made as to how those credits would be applied, in particular to your sentence or in your parole eligibility. Is that correct?
And with the yes, of course she says that, and that's accurate, but then she tells him, and the prosecutor tells him more than once, again on page 12, I understand your argument, I'm not sure what the parole board would do with that. And the prosecutor also acknowledges, obviously, this is on page 6, line 13, obviously that'll be with the Department of Corrections to decide. Fundamentally, they're the ones that have to decide this, I guess, ultimately. So the prosecutor says the last word is up to the parole board of the Department of Corrections. Twice the judge tells him at sentencing, this is what my judgment's going to say, but ultimately it's going to be up to the parole board of the Department of Corrections. So the defendant went to prison, and he heard from the Department of Corrections, and the public-facing DOC website shows us what he's getting. Of course, everyone who enters prison gets a calculation. And now we understood. He got the final word. He got the controlling decision on it from the Department of Corrections, which he was told would be the last word. And it was 1,012 days. And now he said, I didn't understand, and this is not what I expected. And he's asking for a remand for a hearing to see whether that was a material condition of the plea to see if he can get his plea back.
So has he actually made a motion to withdraw the plea?
No, it came as part of the appeal. We did it as part of the appeal.
And you asked for a remand before the appellate division, but before this court, I thought your argument was you're asking us to make the adjustment?
No, Your Honor, I'm not asking that at all. I asked for Kovac
and
Johnson.
Want a remand.
Tradition remedy. That's the cases I cited, and that's all I asked for.
The 3,700 days that apply to the flat 13, the four consecutive counts, if you prevail, and this someday is resolved and goes back for resentencing, do you dispute that he could be sentenced at a much higher rate than he received there when you adjust for the errors that were made to the flat 13?
Actually, I think that's what Your Honor was talking about, Justice Alvin. What really, I think you're referring to the fact that CH talks about you don't get consecutive credit. Okay. Under the current plea agreement, it makes no difference. He's not ahead of the game because he got the consecutive time. Because it was aggregated into the 13, and the 13 is concurrent to the 8.5. So as it stands now, he doesn't get an extra day credit for that. And I think you'll see that early on, the prosecutor filed a cross appeal, and we had talked about that, and she was, if I recall correctly, it was because they were going to challenge the CH grant of credit. And then they withdrew it, the cross appeal, because it didn't give him a single other day.
And I just want to say this slightly differently and see if you disagree. It doesn't matter because of the NERA sentence?
That's right. And because the 13 concurrent is four consecutive sentences, so that's where you're talking. But because it's aggregated to the 13 flat concurrent, it doesn't change
I get that, and I think we all get that.
Okay.
But do you concede, nevertheless, that on the 13 flat, your client got a windfall of jail credits?
Currently, yes, but it's on paper. It's not in reality.
I understand.
And there's the CH problem is one mistake. Take a look at the fourth degree sentences. These were 18 months of imprisonment, mm-hmm. roughly 550 days.
Mm-hmm.
One of them has roughly 1,000 days of jail credit applied, and the other has 900 days of jail credit applied, which is puzzling. He's getting jail credits beyond the actual sentence? Are they being wrapped around for other counts?
My understanding, it really just is on paper. It doesn't make a difference.
Because if you look at it this way, the more counts he pled to, the lesser the penalty would be, which makes no sense at all.
In the long run, as he stands here today, it didn't benefit him because the 8.5 year on this sentence is controlling. I understand the numbers are a little puzzling, but it didn't really.
They don't strike me as puzzling. I think that they're baffling and wrong. This it seems like there were multiple mistakes made with regard to the flat 13?
No? Actually, I have a feeling that, and I would have to check the exact dates, I have a feeling that what happened is he was really held a very long time while they were trying to negotiate all five indictments ultimately, because he ended up starting trial on one of them and then they packaged all of it. So I think he may actually have been in jail.
So let's go back to the near account, which drives this sentence.
Right.
What could or should the judge have said in order for this to go through?
He should not have three times referred to the 2,438 days as jail credit when the only consideration was the parole disqualifier. Somebody should have explained to him it was jail credit, but no one explained to him it's going to be dispersed among the five. As I said, there is absolutely no discussion.
How do we not know I'm explaining that to him? Are you able to represent to us that his attorney was thoroughly ineffective in discussing this matter with him?
I'm talking about what happened at the plea hearing. I'm discussing the plea colloquy. I'm also...
But we don't know what, if any, conversation Mr. McNeil's attorney had with him.
I don't know what happened outside the record. I do know what counsel said at the commencement on page 33. It's been represented to counsel and to the court and to the state. I represented it to Mr. McNeil at the time of sentencing with respect to indictment 1056. He's going to be entitled to 2,438 days of jail credit. I don't think it could be clearer. He's saying it all goes to 1056. 1056 is the 8.5 years without parole. I think counsel put on the record, this is what I'm telling the client.
He was at that time, he was pleading, was he just pleading to the near account, or was he pleading to everything?
He was pleading to everything, but the only sentence discussed and the only credit discussed was 1056 at the plea hearing. I understand your confusion, Your Honor, because none of the other indictments are discussed at the plea hearing. The only credit and the only sentence that was discussed at the plea hearing was the controlling 8.5. And indeed, the judge acknowledges, I got the same paperwork that showed he's getting 2,438 days, and then everyone proceeds to discuss how the 2,438 will affect the parole disqualifier. No one explains to him at this hearing, by the way, this is how it's really going to get dispersed among all five of your indictments.
Well, it seems from the transcript that the judge was not sure how it was going to be dispersed. So is it your position that at that point everything should have stopped until that was actually calculated per indictment, and only at that point the police should have gone forward?
Insofar as the defendant was entitled to an accurate explanation. If the parties, if the bench and the bar did not understand or did not give him an accurate explanation, then the defendant was left with confusing and misleading information. Whether that's a remedy for correcting it, we should stop a plea hearing until everybody can be sure about it.
Well, often jail credit is calculated later. It's only because a number was being bandied about at this point in time it's becoming
It is somewhat, and the judge acknowledges it's somewhat unusual to get the numbers at this point. Although it's... frankly, probably not such a bad idea to get the numbers at this point. And the prosecutor acknowledges, look, he's entitled to whatever credit he's entitled to. I don't think this should all apply to the 8.5 years without parole, but he also didn't say, I want to be clear on the record, you legally can't get it. He just disputed whether it applied. No one told him you can't get it. They told him get it.
Well, so there's no question that Mr. McNeil's attorney represented, well, I think he's going to get that 2004. Mm-hmm. And then the prosecutor says, wait a second, I don't think he's going to get that. He's not entitled to that. And then towards the end of the plea colloquy, the court is saying, I can't represent to you right now whether or not you're going to get that. So what's unclear about that?
Because the judge also referred to it as jail credit, not once, not twice, but three times. Jail credit has a meaning. It means day-for-day credit against
understand.
The sentence.
She's saying, I can't represent to you right now whether the jail credit, which is jail credit, that has been provided to me, is that 2,438. And then she goes on and says it again.
But in the,
not it, promising you that.
In the same sentence, she refers to it as jail credit.
You are going to... about the definition of jail credit. This is jail credit. It's not about the definition day for day. It's about the amount that he was entitled to based on the sentences and the time that he spent. So it's not about the definition of jail credit at all. Everyone agrees what jail credit is. It's about what he was entitled to, which is the numbers, not the definition. Isn't that right?
Actually, not entirely, Your Honor, because the judge does and correctly tries to explain to the defendant some credit is mandatory, some is discretionary, although I think probably after Hernandez there isn't discretionary, but she says to him there's different kinds of credit. At the same time, referring to the 2438 as jail credit.
Tell me what's unclear about this sentence by the court. It's on page 39.
Mm-hmm.
So again, Mr. McNeil, you're entering into this guilty plea, and you understand that there's no representation made as to how those credits would be applied in particular to your sentence and or to your parole ineligibility. Is that correct? Answer yes. Well, tell me what is unclear about that.
What? You can't take a single sentence and lift it out of the context. You have to read it within the context.
How is that out of context? What just Alvin just
because
read. It was at the end. How is that out of context?
It's after they talked about 2,438 days of jail credit.
This is the explanation at the end and not to rely on it. How is that taken out of context when Justice Alvin read it to you?
Then look at the exact words of this sentence that Justice Alvin read to me. It may. I just can't represent it to you.
What's confusing about that?
Because it can't. She said it may, and in fact, as I think we understand, it can't. There's no way he could get the 2,438 days. So first he's told it's jail credit, and jail credit's going to the 1056, the 8.5. Then he's told, well, maybe it will, and then maybe it won't. In fact, it can't. It wouldn't be legal for him to get the two. So she left him with the impression that he might get it as jail credit again.
She repeatedly said to him, just after the reference repeated, I can't represent you. I don't want you to accept this plea thinking that anybody is telling you that's going to be applied to your parole ineligibility. She clearly and repeatedly let him know that the numbers were undetermined at that time. And he said again and again, yes, 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 I understand.
It's not that the numbers were undetermined. No one disputed the 2,438. So that number was solid.
No one disputed.
The prosecutor did.
Yeah. The prosecutor did. And the court made clear she wasn't accepting that number. She said, her language was, that has been provided to me, is that 2,438. I cannot, she's simply saying that's the number here, but she couldn't verify it.
And then she says it again on line 18. Okay, Mr. McNeil, you're entering into this guilty plea, and you understand that there's no representations made as to how those credits would be applied in particular to your sentence and or to your parole ineligibility. Is that correct? Yes, Your Honor.
I think he got conflicting advice. He was told it may, and that's on page 39 at line 5, but I can't be sure it will. And then counsel told him at the opening it should. The prosecutor said, I don't think it should, but who knows. And then at sentencing, after he got the 1,012 days, which I'm not disputing is what he was legally entitled to, he's told none of this is final till the parole board of the Department of Corrections gets their hands on it.
So then the question becomes, can an unreasonable expectation be enough to claim something is not knowing, voluntary, and intelligent as a plea?
I don't think Mr. McNeil plucked the 2,438 days or the jail credit out of the air. All of those terms and numbers were thrown at him at the plea hearing. I think we may be ascribing more understanding or knowledge to credit than the average defendant might understand.
But most defendants don't even have a number. So if he has an unreasonable expectation of not knowing what's going to happen because of all of these disclaimers that are coming from the prosecutor and the judge, isn't he like any other defendant who doesn't know what the jail credit will be? And if he accepts the plea with that piece of unknown out there, why is this plea then not valid?
I think it wasn't unknown that he was told it may, that he was given a hard number and told it may.
No, he was not given a hard number because he was continually taught that may and may not, we're not sure what applies. So how is that a hard number? He was given a number, yes, but that number came with, you know, many statements that it may not be the right number, it may be improper, you may get it, you may not, do not enter into this plea if that's what you're relying on. How is that confuse it to someone.
I think it was confusing and conflicting and misleading. I am saying it was also legally incorrect. And I don't see how the average defendant could sift through all those numbers and understand. Again, they talked only about the 8.5 years without parole.
Your position is that by the judge using the term jail credit, everybody had a basis to understand that it would be day-for-day credit applied to the front end, correct?
There's only one definition of jail credit, so the answer is yes, Your Honor.
So following that same logic, would it also make sense that everybody would understand that jail credit could only mean you get one day for one day served? Isn't that equally plausible for everyone in the courtroom to understand?
Yes, but when you're only talking about a single sentence in a single indictment, when no one adds, they could have easily explained to him, not defense counsel, not the prosecutor, not the judge, no one explained to Mr. McNeil, the jail credit is going to be spread out and divided.
The prosecutor did explain that. He said you can't get more than 3 years of jail credit when you haven't been in jail on the charge for 3 years. He did explain it. He knew it. And everybody knew there was this total number that was more than what he'd been in jail for this charge for. It applied to other charges. The defendant knew that. Everybody knew that. And the prosecutor specifically said that. How can you argue there's no understanding?
The prosecutor didn't say this is going to be distributed among the other sentences.
Did he say you can't get more than three years of jail credit when you haven't been in jail on this charge for more than 3 years?
And then the
did
other
he say that?
He said that, and then the other party said conflicting things to that.
Did
that
he wasn't say that?
I'd have to look exactly what he said, Your Honor.
So here, if you look at page 33 at the bottom and 34, the prosecutor says,
yes.
And if the defendant gets, for instance, 6 years credit for being in jail for 3 years, I don't know. I don't know how that makes any sense.
That's the strongest disclaimer that anyone gave him. The prosecutor says, I don't know how that makes any sense. No one said, you can't get it, you're not going to get it, it's illegal, and the best you can hope for is it will be distributed to the other indictments. He challenged
why
it,
do they have
he
to
questioned
say that?
It.
Why isn't it sufficient at this point for the judge to say, I'm just not representing to you the number of credits you're going to get, okay? No representations are made to you. At that point, if he didn't like that, he could have said, I want to withdraw my plea. I want the representations made now.
Because at the same time, the judge said, it may go. She didn't say, if she had said, I have no idea how this is going to happen.
So what's wrong with
that?
She
said it may,
what's wrong
but it
with
couldn't.
The judge saying, I'm not in a position right now to calculate the jail credits. Okay, so now he's informed. The judge hasn't made a decision. You want to pull out? Pull out.
I don't think it was the requisite degree of explanation that a defendant who is not savvy about credit.
He's certain that he could pull out of a plea. This was the second go around, wasn't it?
Yes.
Okay, so
probably
he certainly knew that he could.
Probably more than second, but the last time I.
But he certainly knew it's not. What I'm saying is, he knew that if he didn't accept the plea, he could just step out of it. It wasn't like he didn't know that you were allowed to walk out. This at least the second time. Because the first time he walked out and there was no plea, and then it came back.
I will not disagree that he understood the concept that you could withdraw. But at this point, everybody had worked so hard to dispose of all five indictments and get a package that I assume they weren't eager to blow it up again and that he wanted to proceed with it, but it just wasn't a clear explanation.
So your argument is that knowing the number of credit he's getting against the 8.5 years was everything to him. That was the crucial question. And in spite of the fact that what I'm going to get is the crucial question, he accepted the plea with the judge saying, you may not get that. That was okay with him, even though it was the crucial question.
I suspect he was waiting to see what
I don't know what he suspects. I'm looking at the record. Yeah, you may not get it. This is the, we're at the plea. Knowing, informed plea. It's crucial, everything. I'm going to accept or reject it based on the jail credits I get toward the 8.5 years. You may, You may not. Okay, I'll take it.
Well, it goes beyond that. The judge said, if you're accepting this plea based on that number, I suggested that you shouldn't do that. So it wasn't just you may or may not get it. The judge went beyond that.
I suspect he was waiting to see how it would play out.
Well, yeah, but we're not mind readers, so we have to understand what the judge gave him sufficient information, saying, if you're relying on that, don't accept the plea. What more than that could the judge have done?
I can tell you that my client has represented to me that he was confused, did not understand, and was surprised that he only got 1,012 days against this sentence.
Did the pre-sentence investigation report break down?
Well, if you...
How many credits did the pre-sentence investigation report allot to the nearest sentence?
In fact, Your Honor, if you look at the... Excuse me, if I may just step over.
The first page of it.
If you look at the first page, it does show 1,012 days on the first indictment, and then if you turn the page, in total, the defendant has accrued 4,727 days of jail time credit.
It's the aggregate as applied to all of the offenses.
That's right. Where did anyone tell him that? That's right. That is absolutely what the 4,727 means.
But the 1,056 is the indictment with the stip, and it says that's all the credit he's getting against him. Doesn't that tell him exactly what you said, and nobody tells him that?
And then at the sentencing hearing, which occurred the day you get the PSR, they told him the final word comes from the Department of Corrections and the Parole Board.
I understand. But the right numbers, they're in front of him. He knows he's not getting 4,000. He already said the number in front of him was 2,400. He knows he's not getting that. And he knows that the 1,012 relates to 1056. How is he being misled?
He was surprised and was telling me that he was confused and misled.
I'm not saying he wasn't surprised. How was he misled?
It was never explained to him at the police specifically, okay. And none of us can point to a place where
it
was explained.
How about this? I don't want you to accept this plea thinking that anybody's telling you that it is going to be applied to your parole and eligibility. Do you understand that, defendant? Yes. How about that?
Because at the same time, the judge said it may and it may not.
This is after.
It's confusing.
It may or may be confusing, but once the judge told him, if you're accepting a plea based on that, don't accept it. And he said, do you understand? And he said, yes. So what part of that is confusing? That comes after what the judge said. That's at the end.
That's the aggregate of what everybody was telling him. It may not.
There was no aggregate mentioned there. It was just saying, if you're relying on that number, don't accept the plea. How is that confusing?
I didn't mean the aggregate.
How could that
number
have been said any clearer? Could you give me an example of what the judge should have said?
The judge should have said, you can't get 2,438 days against this sentence. And that wasn't told to him either. No one flatly told him the 2,438 days that are being discussed as credit will not be applicable to this sentence.
Except for the prosecutor.
Well, the prosecutor said, I don't see how it could, but you're entitled to whatever credit you're entitled to. And he said, I respect the women who prepared this report that cited that. The prosecutor didn't say you can't get it. He said, I don't understand how you could get it, but that's what this paper says.
I think there was confusion about the prosecutor's position.
I think the prosecutor was unhappy that he saw that number, but he never said that is legally incorrect. He said you're entitled to whatever you're entitled to. He also said you can't walk in on an 8.5-year parole disqualifier with most of that time already served. But if you spend enough time in jail, you can. Now, maybe it won't happen as much now under the new bail law. Most people won't spend as much time, but he was saying, how can you walk into prison having served most of your parole disqualifier?
Well, the prosecutor was making a very clear point. He's trying to say, how can you get like 6 years of credit if you've only served 3 years in jail? It didn't make sense to him.
And no one...
That wouldn't make sense to anyone.
Well, we do aggregate it in mysterious ways.
Yeah, but the prosecutor said you can't get that. How is that different than what you're saying they should have told them? You can't get that.
Prosecutor saying, I don't understand how you could get it, but you're entitled. He also said at the same time, you're entitled to whatever credit you're entitled to.
But that was accurate, wasn't it?
You've mentioned a couple of times that there are different ways to aggregate. this offense, the first of the offenses that landed him in jail was in 2013?
I'd have to check, Your Honor. I think that sounds correct.
And the plea colloquy takes place in 2016.
That's correct.
So there's only a 3-year period of time. Under what theory of aggregation, for a single count, could you end up with 6.5 years?
Your Honor, I'm not saying he was entitled to the 2,438. That's not my argument. I'm not saying they could have given him that time, that it could have. I'm saying no one explained to him that he couldn't get it. They told him, maybe you will, maybe you won't. We're not sure.
So are you arguing that his reasonable expectations were not met, or that he was misinformed? If we were looking at this through this prism of a motion to withdraw, which is what you're ultimately asking mm-hmm. for if you get a remand, we have to look at this through the Slater analyses. And prong 2 looks at the reasons for requesting the withdrawal. And many of them go to the reasons for saying that the plea was not knowing and voluntary. They use different words, but when you look at the examples that our court cited in the second prong, it talks about being misinformed about a material element, not being informed about a material element, where the defendant's reasonable expectations were not met. So if we were to look at it through that prism, what would you be arguing for that prong? And second part of the question is, do we balance those arguments against the defendant's arguments on the other three prongs? Because I'm not hearing any argument about a claim for innocence or an analysis of the prejudice to the state if the defendant is allowed to withdraw at this point in time. How do you measure up under those prongs?
Well, Your Honor, I wasn't raising this under Slater, and I expressly stated that in my brief. I spent about a half a page footnote saying I wasn't raising this under Slater. I was raising this under knowing and voluntary, that first the plea has to be entered knowingly and voluntarily, and then Slater kicks in. That's my understanding.
So you think there's a real bright line that we could resolve this purely under a rule, the rule analysis for knowing and voluntary, and not get to all of the other Slater elements?
Yes. If the defendant did not understand the penal consequences of the plea, then he didn't enter it knowingly and voluntarily. I thought that was a fairly traditional argument
that
you could make before Slater. And that's really the argument that I was trying to make here.
And your point, as we've heard you, is by not saying more, he was misinformed and therefore didn't have sufficient understanding.
Confused. Misinformed, confused, and got
Understood.
Conflicting information.
Understood.
So let me ask you a very practical question.
And then we'll ask you to wrap up your argument. Go ahead.
So he was looking for approximately 6 years of jail credits?
Well, 2,438 days. But I'm not, again, Your Honor, I'm not asking for specific performance of the 2,438.
I understand.
Oh, okay.
This is a practical question.
Okay.
Because he's been in jail since 2013.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But if we remanded it, he'd be at the 6-year point. Okay, so
you're saying it's dragged out that long? Well,
it has.
Yeah, it's unfortunate.
Okay, so now, even if he got the credits right now, okay, he still has to serve the rest of his sentence.
I had asked for this relief from the appellate division a couple of years back, so.
No, I understand that, but we are where we are.
Anything you'd like to add at this point? We'll have you back for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Okay. Ms. Pickering.
Chief Justice, Honorable Justices. As many of your questions have shown, this case really is about whether or not there is a reasonable misunderstanding with respect to the extensive colloquy that was held during the second plea attempt. Ms. Bloom has endeavored to explain that her client was misled, that he didn't understand. I would like to stress that this is not a naive or unsophisticated criminal defendant. We're not dealing with that. This is a gentleman who has had 6 juvenile adjudications. He's had 3 disorderly persons convictions, at least 2 violations of probation, 5 felony convictions, 4 of which were resolved by way of a guilty plea, and he has served 4 prison sentences. He understands what's going on. He understands the jail credits. In fact, he even says that he understands the jail credits, and that's on the March 16th transcript on page 33, lines 20 to 23. He says that he has 32 months and some change on my sentence, which is going to be served for that 85%. Right there, you know what this defendant's expectation is with respect to credits, a day-for-day credit for the time that he has put in on that sentence. That is before he rejects the first guilty plea. This is not a defendant who doesn't understand what's going on. This is a defendant who has seized an opportunity when a number was given to him by the probation department reflecting almost 6 years' worth of credits, more than 6 years' worth of credits, on his particular case. We do not know anything about that 2,438 days. There was no written calculation provided. All I know is what is represented in the record. I have not seen a piece of paper that was given to the state at all. From what I can tell, the state learned about it the day of the second plea when they were coming back to court to see how to proceed. That's how the state found out about it. So there's nothing from probation that calculates how they get to 2,438, and there's nothing that says how it's going to apply. The only representations we have are those from defense counsel trying to argue that they should all apply to the stipulation. So I think we have to be very clear on what we are looking at and what we are not. But this is not an unsophisticated defendant, and he understands this and he knows it, and he, 2 days after he says that I have 32 months in on that 85%, he gets a calculation saying you're getting 6.5 years, or he gets a number saying you get 6.5 years of credit on that number. Of course he's going to try and argue for it. It makes sense that he's going to try and argue for it. But to say that he relied on that number is unreasonable. And this is an unreasonable reliance if there was any reliance at all. And I do not feel that, the state does not believe that he relied on that number at all. The state believes he seized the opportunity to try and argue it. But that said, there was some confusion about the number. I think the state's response when that number was given out is absolutely crystal clear. The state never, ever told him that he was entitled to 2,438 days. The court never told him he was entitled to that number because no one had a calculation. It was a number that was provided. Specifically, after hearing the state's argument, the court then warned the defendant, they warned him four times not to enter the plea based on that number, that there is no guarantee how it's going to be applied and he shouldn't do it. And four times he said, yes, I understand. And he said that under oath. So this is something that we have to keep in mind, that this is not just banter in the courtroom. This is a defendant standing in front of a judge who is telling him not to rely on that, and he is under oath at the time, and he says, I know, I understand. So I think that it's very clear that he is not relying on that number, and I think that after this warning, to the extent that he does try and rely on this number, it is unreasonable and false, and he should not be held, this plea should not be upheld, because he didn't knowingly involuntarily enter it. He did know. He knew exactly what he was doing at the time. But that said, I think Your Honor was correct in that after the warning, the court was in corrective mode. The court was doing what was suggested by the appellate division in State v. Elevras, which is clarifying the plea colloquy to represent and address any confusion. Was there more confusion? Probably, because no one knew what that number was comprised of. However, the court did very clearly explain the reliance aspect of this and that you cannot rely on this. And having done that, the court really is at a point where they have done their job, and there's not much more that you can expect from the court.
So while the court is issuing a number of cautionary instructions that we've discussed up until now, there is a sentence that comes in the context of a discussion just about the near account, because that's what all of this debate has been, on page 38, where the court says, at line 21, nobody's making you any promises other than the fact that that is your jail credit, the 2,438 days. That appears to be a reference to the discussion that's taking place about the near account. No?
I think I'm not entirely sure that it is, Your Honor. I think that because we don't know what comprised that 2,438 days, and because he was resolving a plea with five different counts.
We don't, but at no point up until here, or indeed after, is there a discussion about the other counts. It appears from the transcript, and correct me if you have a different understanding, that this is all about the Nira count.
I think at that point it is. I think defense counsel's representation just prior to that discussion with the court, where he says that his client was going into this plea understanding that the 2,438 was going to be applied to his Nira term, framed that calculation. I think the court's explanation there was maybe somewhat less clear, but I think it got clarified with her subsequent representations that you cannot rely on this.
So respond to the claim. The judge here is making a promise that is your jail credit. Was that promise kept?
No. I don't know that the judge is making a promise under those circumstances.
I was quoting the language here.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No one's making any promises other than the fact that is your jail credit. Was that promise kept?
No, I don't believe that promise was kept. That promise was not accurate.
That not problematic in terms of where we stand today?
Because of the clarification that came afterwards where it came today. I think there was a single sentence in there is difficult, it may appear one way, but the judge's clarification afterwards explains that. Again, the other thing about that number is that there were no calculations for that number. So the judge is saying, this is your credit based on a number that was received in some fashion with no supporting calculations.
It's difficult to understand. I can't understand actually what that is, given the sentence that precedes it. So I cannot represent to you right now whether the jail credit, which is a jail credit that has been provided to me, is at 2,438. I'm just reading from the same page that precedes the sentence that the Chief Justice read. That's why it's...
It is confusing, but yeah. I think that the way the words that were used are not the clearest. I mean, calling it all jail credits, he didn't have any other credits coming to him at that point in time. It was jail credits at the time. I think the posture that brought this up was somewhat confusing under the circumstances, and I think that the court then went to step to clarify it. There was no promise that the 2,438, she says it was your jail credit, it is based on that number only, but there is nothing that says how they got to that number, and she is very clear about that, I think, when she comes back and warns him and explains to him, particularly after the state has responded and said, how do you get 6.5 years worth of credit when you have actually served less than 3 years?
So going forward, what should the procedure be? Because this is not rocket science. I mean, you should be able to figure out at the time of the
close.
Plea.
It is close. It's close to rocket science.
Yeah. How many jail credits you're getting on that type of Nira sentence, right?
I have to laugh because I think after CH it is not as much rocket scientist as science as it used to be. I think that going forward...
That was a well-written opinion, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
So, answer yes.
I did say yes. I think that certainly clarified any confusion that was in place. But I think going forward, I think, as I said, you see defendants' expectations in here. And the expectation is...
So CH did a lot of clarification. It's a fantastic job. On the consecutives. But on the one charge, we're just talking about the... That you should be able to calculate. You look at when he began the sentence on that up till the time of sentence.
I certainly agree with you. And I think that was... I don't understand what went into that 2,438. As I said, there were no calculations.
What is in flux, just in general, so to try to prevent problems in the future? Obviously, given CH, mm-hmm. which I won't comment on how well-written it was. He's heard enough of that. But given CH, obviously from plea to sentencing, there's going to be some additional time, right? That's still in flux.
That is correct.
What else is still in flux that would prevent the calculation from being done at least on a tentative basis, subject to whatever weeks or months remain, at the time of a plea hearing, so that there is at least ballpark number out there?
I think it can be done, but it has to be done on a tentative basis. And I think that's where we come into the problem here. I don't know what precipitated that 2,438 number
right.
being given to the defendant. I have
right.
no idea how
and
that came about.
And the sense you have in reading this transcript is that the number is floated out there by somebody.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think we really know where it came from. And nobody, because it's too early in this in the procedure to focus on this, I think, has really sat down and hashed that out. Now, it's got to be done sooner or later. It's got to be done
mm-hmm.
at the time of sentencing,
mm-hmm.
right? Why not do that tentative, subject to change if there are 3 weeks or 2 months or whatever left before sentencing and the defendant remains confined? Why not focus everybody on that issue at the time of a plea hearing?
I think in some circumstances it can be done that way, when a plea is anticipated. When a plea is not anticipated, and I honestly can't tell for sure whether the second plea was anticipated at the time. I personally don't think it was. It didn't seem to come up. That was not the reason why everyone came back to court. But I think you can reach a tentative or a ballpark calculation ahead of time if it is needed and requested. And I think that every defendant who is serving time goes in there and is told by his attorney, you're going to get the credit for the time that you are in jail. I think it gets more questionable when you're talking about serving in a recovery center or something like that. But here we're dealing with straight time that he spent in jail. It was relatively clear. And frankly, the person who got it right was the defendant when he said, I have this. I spent 32 months here, and that's going to my 85%. And he was absolutely right. I think it can be done. I think now that CH is out there and has clarified some of that, it's easier to deal with that. Prior to that, it was a little more difficult, I think. There were many cases that had confusion as a result of that.
Right.
However, it can be done, but I think it depends on how much time you have. But I think it has to be made clear that you cannot specifically rely on a number, and that has to be made clear to a defendant. You could give them a ballpark and say, you've been in jail 3 years. Okay, you're going to get 3 years applied to this sentence. It does get a little more confusing when you have multiple sentences and depends on how those sentences are going to be served. Are they concurrent? Are they consecutive? Is that going to impact it one way or another?
But sooner or later, that's got to be done. Somebody has to spend the arithmetic
mm-hmm.
time and figure it all out, and it's not easy
it's
to
not.
Do it.
And that's why it's done after sentencing.
When you could come up with the exact precise number. But
exactly. That's why it's done after sentencing, when you sit down and you get the pre-sentence report that has all the calculations in it, that goes through and says he was in jail from this date to this date on this charge and this date to this date on this charge. And that's all in the pre-sentence report, which was accurate in terms of the amount of time spent. How it was applied is a different matter, but that's not why we're here. We're here because of what he claims to have relied on with respect to the plea. But I do think it can be done. But I think it has to be stressed that you cannot rely on a specific number at that point in time, and it needs to be made clear what some of the complications are.
Anything else you'd like to add?
I do not believe I do. Thank you very much.
Ms. Oberholzer.
Good morning, Your Honors. The Attorney General agrees with the state that in this case the defendant was put on notice, that he should not be relying on that. But I will rely on her argument on that unless the court has any questions and address how to avoid this in the future. Hopefully with CH there are no longer a lot of questions as to what time you're entitled to, but there are going to be cases where a defendant may be in and out of jail, where he may be in a recovery center, and you need to determine whether he completed a program satisfactorily. Maybe there are interstate issues where he was picked up on a warrant under the interstate agreement on detainers. Those are all things that could make it a tricky calculation. And the reality is sometimes defendants decide to take a plea without a whole lot of warning, and probation will not have had time to do this. In this case, the defendant initially said he was going to take a plea in the middle of a trial. Nobody was anticipating that and calculating his time. So ideally, a defendant should just be told, you are entitled to whatever time you're entitled. Probation will calculate that. It is not a element of the plea. If it's really critical to a defendant and his decision to plead rests on that number, then a final determination should be made by probation as to what that number is before the plea is accepted by the court, which didn't happen here. We had sort of a number which, as best I can figure, is the aggregate of the time defendant had served on the last three arrests. The first two arrests don't seem to have been calculated into this at all, even though he was pleading on them as well.
And of course, it's not a final determination.
Right.
Because it's only as good as the day on which that discussion is taking place.
Correct.
It's most definitely going to be wrong by the time you get to the day of sentencing.
Right.
When you will need another calculation to have been conducted.
And there may be circumstances where you can say to a defendant, well, so far you have been in for 850 days on this. That's the minimum number of time you're going to get, although with bail reform I would hope there aren't too many people who have been in 850 days by the time they plead. But, you know, it would be nice if we could have a firm number every time somebody pled, but the reality of the way guilty pleas often arise makes that difficult to do.
Questions, anyone?
No.
Thank you. Ms. Bloom. Thank you, counsel. We'll take the matter under advisement. Anyone need a break?